buttons around the ankles. He pocketed his bamboo reed, pulled his ankle strings as tight as he could, and headed to the banjo. Once inside, he jammed one end of the reed through the knothole hard enough to pierce the grain sack, then put the other end into his pajama fly. The grain, rice, poured through the reed and into his pants. When he had about 5 pounds in each leg, Louis pulled the reed out. Louis walked out of the banjo, moving as naturally as a man could with 10 pounds of rice in his pajamas. He strolled past the barracks guards and climbed the ladder to the second floor, where Commander Fitzgerald awaited him, a blanket spread before him. Louis stepped onto the blanket, untied his pant legs, and let the rice spill out, then hurried back to his bunk. Fitzgerald quickly folded up the blanket, then hid the rice in socks and secret compartments he had made under the wall panels. After memorizing the guards' routines, Louis and Fitzgerald would wait for a time when the guards left the building, then dig out the rice, rush it to the building stove, boil it in water, and scoop it into their mouths as rapidly as they could, sharing it with a few others. They never got more than about a tablespoon of rice per man, but the accomplishment of outwitting their slaveholders was nourishment enough. In Nawetsu's little POW insurgency, perhaps the most insidious feat was pulled off by Louis's friend, Ken Marvin, a Marine who'd been captured at Wake Atoll. At his worksite, Marvin was supervised by a one-eyed civilian guard called Bad Eye. When Bad Eye asked Marvin to teach him English, Marvin saw his chance. With secret delight, he began teaching Bad Eye catastrophically bad English. From that day forward, when asked, "How are you?" Bad Eye would smilingly reply, "What the fuck do you care?" Disaster struck Louis one day that spring on the riverbank. He'd been transferred back to hauling, and was hunched under a basket, lugging a heavy load of salt from a barge to a railroad car. He carried his basket up the riverbank, then began the perilous walk up the rail car ramp. As he made his way up, a guard stepped onto the top of the ramp and started down. As they passed, the guard threw out his elbow, and Louis, top-heavy under the basket, fell over the side. He managed to get his legs under him before he hit the ground, some 4 feet down. One leg hit before the other. Louis felt a tearing sensation, then scorching pain in his ankle and knee. Louis couldn't bear any weight on the leg. Two POWs supported him while he hopped back to camp. He was removed from barge duty, but this was hardly comforting. Not only would he now be the only officer trapped in camp with the bird all day, but his rations would be cut in half. Louis lay in the barracks, ravenous. His dysentery was increasingly severe, and his fevers were growing worse, sometimes spiking to 104 degrees. To get his rations restored, he had to find work that he could do on one leg. Spotting an abandoned sewing machine in a shed, he volunteered to tailor the guard's clothes in exchange for full rations. This kept him going for a while, but there was soon no one left to tailor for, and his rations were halved again. Such was his desperation that he went to the bird and begged for work. The bird savored his plea. From now on, he said, Louis would be responsible for the pig in the compound. The job would earn him full rations, but there was a catch. Louis was forbidden to use tools to clean the pig's sty. He'd have to use his hands. All his life, Louis had been fastidious about cleanliness, so much so that in college he had kept Listerine in his car's glove compartment so he could rinse his mouth after kissing girls. Now he was condemned to crawl through the filth of a pig's sty, picking up feces with his bare hands and cramming handfuls of the animal's feed into his mouth to save himself from starving to death. Of all of the violent and vile abuses that the bird had inflicted upon Louis, none had horrified and demoralized him as did this. If anything is going to shatter me, Louis thought, this is it. Sickened and starving, his will a fraying wire, Louis had only the faint hope of the war's end and rescue to keep him going. Chapter 29 220 Punches. At 11:30 on the morning of May 5, 1945, the sound of four massive engines broke the silence over Nawetsu. A B-29 was turning circles over the village. Sirens sounded, but in the steel mill, the foreman ignored them, and the POWs continued working the furnaces. Then there was a sudden, enormous crash, and it began snowing very hard inside the mill. It wasn't snow, but a tremendous quantity of dust falling from the rafters. Something had shaken the mill violently. The foreman announced that the sound had only been a transformer blowing up and kept the men working. A moment later, a worker ran in and said something urgently to the foreman. The Japanese dropped everything and sprinted out, abandoning the POWs as they ran for the air raid shelters on the beach. Gathering that only a B-29 could make the foreman run like that, the panicked POWs crowded together in a small room, praying that they wouldn't get hit. They didn't. The B-29's bombs missed the plant, blowing gaping holes in a field nearby. It took an hour for everyone, captive and free, to calm down. The guards did their best to impress the POWs with the incompetence of American airmen, taking them on a crater tour to show how badly the bomber had missed, but they were spooked. There was much more to this raid than a couple of holes in a farmer's field, and everyone knew it. For the POWs kept in ignorance of the Pacific War's progression, this raid and the growing number of B-29 sightings over the village raised a dazzling possibility. If the Americans were turning their efforts toward a lone steel mill in a place as obscure as Naoetsu, had the B-29s already destroyed the big strategic cities? The answer came 10 days later. 400 new POWs tramped through the gates and halted in the compound. The bird leapt onto a perch over them and delivered his standard harangue. You must be sober. You must be sincere. You must work for earnest. You must obey. I have spoken. Who the hell is Ernest? Muttered a POW. When the bird was finished, the 400 new men wedged into the barracks with the 300 old ones, and the banjos raneth over. The new men said they'd come from slave camps in the huge cities of Kobe, a matrix of war production, and Osaka, Japan's biggest port. Weeks before, B-29s had swept over those cities in gleaming 300-plane swarms, showering them in fire. Large swaths of Kobe and Osaka had been burned to the ground. Of no use to Japan in razed cities, the POWs had been shipped to Naoetsu to be re-enslaved for the empire. The new men had one other piece of news. Germany had fallen. The whole weight of the Allies was now thrown against Japan. That month, the bird's presence at Naoetsu became sporadic. On top of his duty at Naoetsu, he'd been named disciplinary officer for Mitsushima, a camp in the mountains. He arrived there with his trademark flourish, bursting through a door and shouting, Nanda, at a group of startled POW officers, demanding to know what they were doing. Immediately, he set to beating the officers day and night. The POWs there called him the Knob. The bird was so vicious at Mitsushima that the POW officers soon concluded that they had to kill him to save themselves. Conspirators formed murder squads, set on drowning the bird or hurling him from a cliff. Whenever the bird was in camp, they stalked him. But he seemed to be onto them, moving about with armed guards. Meanwhile, two POW physicians, Richard Whitfield and Alfred Weinstein, hatched a plan to poison the bird with massive doses of atropine and morphine. Again, the bird eluded them. The day after the doctors formed their plan, the bird had the pharmacy medications locked up. Whitfield devised a new plan. Preparing a bottle of saline solution and glucose to serve as a culture medium, he mixed in stool samples from two patients infected with amoebic and bacillary dysentery, tossed in three flies, then stored the bottle next to his skin for several days to incubate the pathogens. He and Weinstein delivered it to the POW cook, who poured it into the bird's rice for the better part of a week. To their amazement, the bird didn't get sick. So the doctors mixed up a new dose, using the stools of 6 ill POWs. This time, they hit the jackpot. In 2 days, the bird was violently ill, completely incapacitated with rocketing diarrhea and 105-degree fever. Weinstein found him in his room crying and whimpering like a child. The bird ordered Weinstein to cure him. Weinstein gave him what he said were sulfa pills. Suspicious, the bird made Weinstein take some of the pills himself. Weinstein took them, knowing that all that was in them was aspirin and baking soda. The bird lost 15 pounds in 1 week. Weinstein urged him to eat his rice. With the bird out of the way, the men and even the guards were, wrote Weinstein, almost hysterically childish in their delight. But the bird seemed unmurderable. After 10 days, his fever broke. He returned to Naoetsu to take out his rage on the officers and Louis. By June, Louis's leg was healed enough to bear his weight, and he was sent back to shovel coal and salt. He was growing ever sicker, and his dysentery never eased. When he appealed for rest while burning up with fever, the bird refused him. His temperature was only 103, he said. You go to work. Louis went. One day that month, Louis, Tinker, and Wade were shoveling on a barge when the foreman discovered that fish had been stolen from the galley. The foreman announced that if the thieves didn't turn themselves in, he'd report the theft to the bird. During a lunch break, the innocent man persuaded the culprits to confess. When the men walked into camp that night, the foreman told the bird anyway, as he suspected that more men had been in on the theft. The bird called for the work party to line up before him and ordered the thieves to stand before the group. He then walked down the line, pulling out Wade, Tinker, Louis, and two other officers, and making them stand with the thieves. He announced that these officers were responsible for the behavior of the thieves. His punishment? Each enlisted man would punch each officer and thief in the face as hard as possible. The chosen men looked at the line of enlisted men in terror. There were some 100 of them. Any man who refused to carry out the order, the bird said, would meet the same fate as the officers and thieves. He told the guards to club any men who didn't strike the chosen men with maximum force. The enlisted men had no choice. At first, they tried to hit softly, but the bird studied each blow. When a man didn't punch hard enough, the bird would begin shrieking and clubbing him, joined by the guards. Then the errant man would be forced to hit the victim repeatedly until the bird was satisfied. Louis began whispering to each man to get it over with and hit hard. Some of the British men whispered, "Sorry, sir," before punching Wade. For the first few punches, Louis stayed on his feet. But his legs soon began to waver, and he collapsed. He pulled himself upright, but fell again with the next punch, and then the next. Eventually, he blacked out. When he came to, the bird forced the men to resume punching him, screaming, "Next! Next! Next!" In Louis's whirling mind, the voice began to sound like the tramping of feet. The sun sank. The beating went on for some 2 hours, the bird watching with fierce and erotic pleasure. When every enlisted man had done his punching, the bird ordered the guards to club each one twice in the head with a kendo stick. The victims had to be carried to the barracks. Louis's face was so swollen that for several days he could barely open his mouth. By Wade's estimate, each man had been punched in the face some 220 times. June 1945 became July. Every day, a single B-29 crossed over Naoetsu, so high that only the contrails gave it away. The men called it the Lone Ranger. Every night, bombers passed over in strength, forests of planes brushing over the village. To the POWs, they were a beautiful sight, all lit up, wrote POW Joe Byrne, as if they were going to a picnic. Throughout each day and night, the air raid sirens kept kicking in. Sometimes at night, the men could hear soft booming in the darkness. Louis was sick and demoralized. He lay on his plank daydreaming about the Olympics, holding them before himself as a shining promise, a future for which to endure an unbearable present. He prayed ceaselessly for rescue. His nightmares of his battles with the bird were hellish, unbearable. His hope was dimming. In his barracks one day, a man dragged in from slave work looking spent. He lay down, asked to be awakened for dinner, and went still. At chow time, Louis kicked his foot. The man didn't move. He was dead. He was young, like everyone else, and hadn't even looked sick. The food situation was increasingly dire. In the spring, with the import of the Kobe and Osaka POWs, the camp population had more than doubled, but the rations had not. Now the rations were smaller still, usually consisting of nothing but seaweed. When a famished prisoner tried to get food from civilians, the bird broke his jaw. Several POW officers appealed to the authorities for meat. To withhold it, they said, violated international law. After this appeal, two guards left camp and returned with a dog, reportedly the only one left in Naoetsu. The next morning, a bell rang, and Louis walked into the compound. There, impaled on a post facing the POWs, was the dog's skinned head. A few minutes later, the men were served breakfast. In the bowls were the remains of the dog. As summer stretched on and the rations dwindled, Louis and the other POWs began looking toward winter with dread. They were told that both their rations and the barracks' heating fuel were going to be cut more come winter and might be halted altogether. Many of the men were already so thin and sick that they were, wrote one, hanging on from day to day. Few POWs in Naoetsu or anywhere else thought they'd live to see another spring. At Omori, someone made up a slogan, "Frisco dive in 45 or stiff as sticks in 46. There was a worry more pressing yet. Even in isolated Naoetsu, it was obvious to the POWs that the Japanese Empire was staggering. Watching B-29s crossing over with impunity, they knew that Japan's air defenses had been gutted and that the Americans were very close. The civilians that they saw were in shocking condition. The limbs of the adults were grotesquely swollen from beriberi. The children were emaciated. The POWs were so disturbed by the obvious famine among the civilians that they stopped stealing at the work sites. It was clear to them that Japan had long ago lost this war. But Japan was a long way from giving in. If a massively destructive air war would not win surrender, invasion seemed the only possibility. POWs all over the country were noticing worrisome signs. They saw women holding sharpened sticks, practicing lunges at stacks of rice straw, and small children being lined up in front of schools, handed wooden mock guns and drilled. Japan, whose people deemed surrender shameful, appeared to be preparing to fight to the last man, woman, or child. Invasion seemed inevitable and imminent, both to the POWs and to the Japanese. Having been warned of the kill-all order, the POWs were terrified. At Borneo's Batu Lintang POW camp, which held 2,000 POWs and civilian captives, Allied fighters circled the camp every day. A civilian warned POW G.W. Pringle that the Japanese have orders no prisoners are to be recaptured by Allied forces. All must be killed. Villagers told of having seen hundreds of bodies of POWs in the jungle. "This, then, is a forerunner of a fate which must be ours," wrote Pringle in his diary. A notoriously sadistic camp official began speaking of his empathy for the POWs and how a new camp was being prepared where there was ample food, medical care, and no more forced labor. The POWs knew it was a lie, surely designed to lure them into obeying an order to march that would, as Pringle wrote, afford the Japs a wonderful opportunity to carry out the Japanese government order to kill them all. Pringle was right. In the camp office sat written orders drawn up by the commander and approved by central military authorities for all captives to be liquidated on September 15th. Women and children would be poisoned, civilian men would be shot, the sick and disabled would be bayoneted. The 500 POWs would be marched 21 miles into the jungle, shot, and burned. At Omori, Japanese kitchen workers, as well as some soldiers, told the POWs that plans for their destruction had been set. The POWs would be turned loose on the excuse that the guards were needed to defend Japan, and when the men stepped onto the bridge, the guards would mow them down with machine guns. The POW officers met to discuss it, but couldn't come up with any way to prevent it or defend themselves. At camps across Japan, things looked just as ominous. Machine guns and barrels of accelerant were brought in. Metal dog tags were confiscated in an apparent effort to comply with the stipulation that those executing POWs not leave any traces. Prisoners were ordered to dig tunnels and caverns, and at a number of camps, friendly guards warned POWs that mines, ditches, and tunnels were going to be used as death chambers. That summer, at Phil and Fred Garrett's camp, Sensuji, officials suddenly announced that they were separating the Americans from the other POWs. The official said that the Americans were being moved to a pleasant new camp for their safety. The men were loaded onto a train and taken across Japan through sad rivers of refugees. Peeking past the drawn window blinds, they saw razed cities. The air smelled of burned bodies. After dark, they reached a remote area. The men were told to begin walking up a nearly impassable trail, winding up the side of a mountain. In a crashing rainstorm, they hiked for hours, through forest, over boulders, and through ravines, climbing so high that the surrounding mountains were capped in snow in summer. Garrett, his stump still unhealed, labored on his crutches, and the Japanese wouldn't allow anyone to help him. Men began fainting from exhaustion, but the Japanese drove the group on, allowing no rest stops. Drenched to the skin, the POWs limped up the path for 11 miles, leaving a trail of discarded possessions as they tried to lighten their loads. At 2 in the morning, high on the mountain, Phil, Garrett, and the other POWs reached a collection of wooden shacks in a rocky clearing. Too exhausted to stand in formation, they collapsed. They were told that this was their new camp, Rokuroshi. No one explained why the POWs had been taken so far from anywhere and anyone to a place that appeared uninhabitable. The POW physician, Hubert Van Pienen, looked about him, considered their situation, and came to a conclusion. This is the place of our extermination. At Naoetsu that summer, camp officials began speaking of their concern that the POWs could be injured in air raids. For this reason, the officials said, the prisoners were soon going to be taken into the mountains where they'd be safe. Away from their officers, the guards told a different story, telling the POWs that the army had issued orders to kill them all in August. This might have been dismissed as a lie, but that July, a civilian worker known for his sympathy for POWs warned a prisoner that an execution date had been set. The date he gave was the same as the one that had reportedly been mentioned to prisoners in at least two other camps. All of the Naoetsu POWs, the civilian said, would be killed on August 22nd. Chapter 30. The Boiling City. No one in Naoetsu was sleeping. B-29s crossed over every night, and the air raid sirens wailed for hours on end, competing with the roar of the planes. The sound of them and the sight of endless flocks of planes soaring unopposed over Japan sent the bird ever deeper into madness. During the raids, the POWs were ordered to stay in the barracks with the lights out. Once the planes had passed, the bird would bound in, ordering the Americans outside. He and his henchman, Kono, would pace back and forth, shouting and swinging clubs, kendo sticks, or rifles. On some nights, the bird would shove the men into two lines, facing one another, and order them to slap each other's faces. Sometimes he and Kono would make them stand with their arms over their heads for 2 or 3 hours at a time, or force them into the Ofuna crouch, pounding them when they faltered. During one beating, Louis was clubbed on his previously injured ankle, leaving it so painful that he could barely walk. And on at least one of these nights, the bird beat Louis to unconsciousness. Louis's job as pig custodian was over. Barge loading had also been canceled. Allied planes had sunk so many Japanese ships that none came or went from Naoetsu anymore. Louis was back on half rations. Limping, sick, and hungry, he begged the bird for work so he could get full rations again. The bird brought him a paper-thin gray goat that appeared to be on the brink of death. "Goat die, you die," the bird said. Louis had nothing to secure the goat with, and no pen to put him in. His friend Ken Marvin stole a rope from his worksite and brought it to him. Louis tied the goat to a pole and began nursing him, giving him water and grain. At night, he tied him inside a grain shack. The goat only got sicker. One morning, the bird ordered Louis to come before him. He said that the goat had gotten loose, broken into a grain bin, and gorged himself. The animal was deathly ill, and it was Louis's fault. Louis knew that his knot had been secure. If the goat had gotten loose, someone had untied him. The goat died. Terrified of retribution, Louis tried to hide from the bird, but his dysentery was becoming very serious. Risking being seen by the bird, he went to the camp doctor to plead for medication. The bird ran him down, demanding to know if he had received permission to approach the doctor. Louis said no. The bird marched Louis away from the doctor's shack, passing Tinker and Wade, who'd been ordered to work outside. Out in the compound, the bird halted. Lying on the ground before him was a thick, heavy wooden beam, some 6 feet long. "Pick it up," the bird said. With some effort, Louis hoisted it up, and the bird ordered him to lift it high and hold it directly over his head. Louis heaved the beam up. The bird called a guard over. "If the prisoner lowers his arms," the bird told him, "hit him with your gun." The bird walked to a nearby shack, climbed on the roof, and settled in to watch. Louis stood in the sun, holding up the beam. The bird stretched over the roof like a contented cat, calling to the Japanese who walked by, pointing to Louis and laughing. Louis locked his eyes on the bird's face, radiating hatred. Several minutes passed. Louis stood, eyes on the bird. The beam felt heavier and heavier, the pain more intense. The bird watched Louis, amused by his suffering, mocking him. Wade and Tinker went on with their work, stealing anxious glances at the scene across the compound. Wade had looked at the camp clock when Louis had first lifted the beam. He became more and more conscious of how much time was passing. 5 more minutes passed, then 10. Louis's arms began to waver and go numb. His body shook. The beam tipped. The guard jabbed Louis with his gun, and Louis straightened up. Less and less blood was reaching his head, and he began to feel confused, his thoughts gauzy, the camp swimming around him. He felt his consciousness slipping, his mind losing adhesion, until all he knew was a single thought: "He cannot break me." Across the compound, the bird had stopped laughing. Time ticked on, and still Louis remained in the same position, conscious and yet not, the beam over his head, his eyes on the bird's face, enduring long past when his strength should have given out. "Something went on inside of me," he said later. "I don't know what it was." There was a flurry of motion ahead of him, the bird leaping down from the roof and charging toward him, enraged. Watanabe's fist rammed into Louis's stomach, and Louis folded over in agony. The beam dropped, striking Louis's head. He flopped to the ground. When he woke, he didn't know where he was or what had happened. He saw Wade and some other POWs, along with a few guards, crouched around him. The bird was gone. Louis had no memory of the last several minutes and had no idea how long he'd stood there. But Wade had looked at the clock when Louis had fallen. Louis had held the beam aloft for 37 minutes. On the night of August 1st, sirens sounded and the village shook. In the barracks, the POWs looked out and saw wave after wave of superfortresses. In the skies over Japan that night, America was staging by far the biggest air raid by tonnage of World War II. 836 B-29s bearing more than 6,100 tons of bombs, incendiaries, and mines. The POWs working the factory night shifts ran for the beach shelters, but the planes bypassed Naoetsu. In Nagaoka, 40 miles away, civilians looked up and thought it was raining. The rain was napalm. With the bombers sweeping overhead, the bird stormed into the barracks and shouted for all Americans to get out. As the men lined up in the compound, the bird and Kono picked up their kendo sticks, walked behind them, and began smashing them over their heads. Men started falling. When Louis went down, the bird crouched over him, clubbing him. Woozy, Louis lay there as the bird and the sirens screamed. At dawn, the sirens went silent. The POWs on the beach came out of the shelters. In the compound, the bird and Kono went still. Louis stumbled to his feet and looked to the northeast. The edge of the world was glowing. Nagaoka was burning down. That same night, B-29s showered leaflets over 35 Japanese cities, warning civilians of coming bombings and urging them to evacuate. The Japanese government ordered civilians to turn the leaflets into authorities, forbade them from sharing the warnings with others, and arrested anyone with leaflets in their possession. Among the cities listed on the leaflets were Hiroshima and Nagasaki. That night was a turning point for Louis. The next morning, his dysentery was suddenly extremely severe. He was dangerously dehydrated and beginning to have trouble eating. Each day he was thinner, weaker. Every day and night, the B-29s raked over the sky and the bird rampaged through camp. He attacked Ken Marvin, knocked him unconscious, roused him with a bucket of water to his face, told him to take care of his health, then knocked him out again. While Louis hid upstairs on his bunk, sick with fever, he saw the bird and Kono beat two sick POWs until they acquiesced to the bird's order to lick excrement from their boots. On another day, Louis looked across the compound to see the bird and Kono standing before a line of POWs, holding a confiscated book on boxing and taking turns punching the prisoners. Louis was walking in the compound when the bird collared him and dragged him to the overflowing Benjo pit. After pulling over several men, the bird forced Louis and the others down on their stomachs, on top of the waste pits, and ordered them to do push-ups. Louis was just barely able to hold his body clear of the pit. Others were not so fortunate. When the exhausted men failed to push themselves all the way up, the bird pressed the butt of his rifle to their heads and ground their faces into the waste. Then came the day that Louis had been dreading. He was standing outside, filling a tub of water, when the bird barked at him to come over. When Louis arrived, the bird looked wrathfully at him and gestured toward the water. "Tomorrow, I'm going to drown you." Louis spent a day gripped with fear, looking for the bird, thinking about the tub of water. When the bird found him, he was terrified. "I have changed my mind," the bird said. Then he lunged at Louis and began punching him in the face, alternating right and left fists in a violent ecstasy. As abruptly as he had started, he stopped. Suddenly serene, he let go of Louis. "I will drown you tomorrow," he said. The bird strolled away. His face wore the same soft languor that Louis had seen on the face of the quack after he beat Harris at Ofuna. It was an expression of sexual rapture. Louis could take no more. He joined about a dozen officers in a secret meeting. By the time they parted, they had a plan to kill the bird. The plan was simple. The men would leap onto the bird and pull him to the top floor of the barracks overlooking the drop to the Hokura River. There they would lash him to a large rock and shove him out the window. When he struck the water below, the rock would carry him under. He would never draw another breath. The officers divvied up the tasks involved in the killing. A group of men would figure out how to overpower the bird, who was quite fit and would be difficult to subdue. Several of the biggest POWs would find a heavy but portable rock, and out of view of the guards, hoist it up the ladders and roll it to the window. Louis was tasked with stealing enough strong rope to lash the rock to the bird. Louis couldn't find a rope long enough to tie a man to a boulder. He began stealing shorter lengths of rope, secreting them away, then tying them together with his strongest Boy Scout knots. Meanwhile, the rock crew found a large boulder, big enough to drown the bird and several other men. Somehow, they got it into the compound, into the barracks, and up the ladder without discovery. They positioned it by the window. When Louis had finally stolen enough rope, he tied it into one long line. It was looped around the rock, a dangling end lying ready to be wound around the bird's body. Louis then prepared for the second phase of the plan. He had volunteered to be one of the men to capture the bird, drag him up, and throw him to his death. As the conspirators planned, the bird entered the barracks. If the rock was then in place, he either didn't see it or didn't recognize what it was there for. He dug through the men's possessions. Under the tatami mat of an English officer, he found a piece of paper on which were listed the crimes of each of the Japanese officials. When the bird looked up, he saw the man sneering at him. The bird was spooked. He believed that he saw the POWs glaring murderously at him. They had never looked at him in this way before. He knew that Japan was losing the war, and that when the end came, the Americans would try him. These POWs would accuse him of crimes, and the Americans would surely sentence him to death. No one, he knew, would defend him, and that fact left him angry and panicked. He was going to have to go to extreme measures to save himself. Next to a window, near which the bird passed each day, the rock and rope sat ready. From the barracks window, it was a long plunge to the water. At 3:15 on the morning of August 6, 1945, a B-29 skipped off runway Able on Tinian Island. At the yoke was Paul Tibbets, a veteran bomber pilot. The plane headed north toward Japan. The mission was so secret that Tibbets carried cyanide capsules for all of the crewmen, to be used if they crashed and were captured. As the day's first light walked over the Pacific, the plane rose toward its bombing altitude, more than 30,000 feet. Two crewmen climbed into the bomb bay. There sat a 12-foot-long, 9,000-pound bomb called Little Boy. The men dropped to their hands and knees and crawled around the bomb, pulling out test plugs and replacing them with firing plugs. Little Boy was armed. Crossing the inland sea, Tibbets saw a city ahead. A scout plane flying over it radioed back in code. The weather was clear. They wouldn't have to bypass this city and pursue the alternate targets. Tibbets spoke over the interphone. "It's Hiroshima." The plane passed the coastline and crossed over the city. Tibbets turned the plane west, then ordered his crew to don shaded goggles. Below, he saw a T-shaped bridge, the target. Tibbets surrendered control of the plane to the Norden bombsite, and the bombardier lined up on the bridge. At 8:15 and 17 seconds, the bomb slipped from the plane. Tibbets turned the plane as hard as he could and put it into a dive to gain speed. It would take 43 seconds for the bomb to reach its detonation altitude, a little less than 2,000 feet. No one knew for sure if in that brief time the bomber could get far enough away to survive what was coming. One of the crewmen counted seconds in his head. When he hit 43, nothing happened. He didn't know that he had counted too quickly. For an instant, he thought the mission had failed. Exactly as the thought crossed his mind, the sky over the city ripped open in a firestorm of color and sound and felling wind. A white light, 10 times the intensity of the sun, enveloped the plane as the flash and sound and jolt of it skidded out in all directions. The tail gunner, looking out the back of the plane through his goggles, thought that the light had blinded him. Tibbets' teeth began tingling, and his mouth filled with a taste of lead. He would later be told that it was the metal in his fillings resonating with the radioactivity of the bomb. He looked ahead and saw the entire sky swirling in pink and blue. Next to him, the co-pilot scribbled 2 words in his diary. "My God." Behind him, the tail gunner's vision cleared, and he saw an eerie, shimmering warp in the air over the city, ripping toward them at 1,000 feet per second. "Here it comes," he said. The shockwave slammed into the plane, pitching the men into the air and back down again. In confusion, someone yelled, "Flak!" Then a second wave, a consequence of the force of the explosion hitting the ground and then ricocheting upwards, smacked them, and the plane heaved again. At POW Camp 10D on the far side of the mountains by Hiroshima, prisoner Farron Cummins felt a concussion roll down from the hills, and the air warmed, strangely. He looked up. A fantastically huge, roiling cloud, glowing bluish-gray, swaggered over the city. It was more than 3 miles tall. Below it, Hiroshima was boiling. Chapter 31. The Naked Stampede. The Nauetsu POWs knew that something big had happened. The guards paced around with stricken faces. Civilians walked past the camp, eyes dazed, hands in fists. A guard said something to Louis that stuck in his head. Hiroshima had been hit by cholera. The city was shut down, he said, and no one could come or go. At one of the work sites, a civilian told a different story. One American bomb, he said, had destroyed an entire city. The POWs thought that he must have meant one raid with many bombs, but the man kept repeating that it was one bomb. He used a word that sounded like atomic. The word was unfamiliar, and no one knew how one bomb could wipe out a city. Tom Wade got hold of a newspaper. Something the paper called an electronic bomb had been dropped, and many people had died. The POWs didn't know what to make of it. At Omori, the shaken camp commander gathered the POWs. One plane came over, he said, and a whole city disappeared. He asked if anyone knew what weapon could do such a thing. No one had an answer. On August 9th, Nagasaki, like Hiroshima, disappeared. Uneasy days passed. Everything in Naoetsu remained the same, and day and night the POWs were still sent to labor in Japan's war production factories. Clearly, something catastrophic had happened, but Japan had not given in. For the POWs, time had all but run out. It was now approaching mid-August, and the kill-all policy loomed. Even if Japan surrendered, many POWs believed that the guards would kill them anyway, either out of vengeance or to prevent them from testifying to what had been done to them. Indeed, an Omori interrogator had told Commander Fitzgerald that the Japanese had plans to kill the POWs in the event that they lost the war. With officials talking about taking them to a new camp in the hills, the POWs believed that the Japanese planned to dump their bodies in a mountain forest where no one would ever find them. They discussed defending themselves, but they had no answers to 25 guards with rifles. Escape, too, was impossible. The camp was cornered against the sea and two rivers, and with no way to get boats for 700 prisoners, the only route out was toward the village, where the sickly, weak men would be caught easily. They were fish in a barrel. Louis lingered in his bunk, fading, praying. In his nightmares, he and the bird fought death matches, the bird trying to beat him to death, Louis trying to strangle the life from the sergeant. He'd been staying as far as he could from the bird, who had been whipping about camp like a severed power line, but the sergeant always hunted him down. Then, abruptly, the violence stopped. The bird had left camp. The guard said that he had gone to the mountains to ready the promised new camp for the POW officers. The August 22nd kill-all death date was 1 week away. On August 15th, Louis woke gravely ill. He was now having some 20 bloody bowel movements a day. After the month's weigh-in, he didn't record his weight in his diary, but he did note that he'd lost 6 kilos, more than 13 pounds, from a frame already wasted from starvation. When he gripped his leg, his fingers sank in, and the imprints remained for long after. He'd seen too many men die to be ignorant of what this meant. Berry. In late morning, after the night work crews had dragged in and the day crews had headed off, Louis crept out of the barracks. With the bird away, it was safer to walk in the open. Crossing the compound, Louis saw Ogawa, his overseer at the potato field. Ogawa had always been an innocuous man, one of the few Japanese whom Louis had never had reason to fear. But when he saw Louis, Ogawa yanked out his club and struck Louis in the face. Louis reeled in astonishment, his cheek bleeding. A few minutes later, at noon, the compound was suddenly, eerily silent. The Japanese were all gone. At the same moment, in the factory mess halls, the POWs looked up from their bowls and realized that they were alone. The guards had left. In camp, Tinker walked through the compound. Passing the guard room, he glanced inside. There were the guards, crowded around a radio in rapt attention, listening to a small, halting Japanese voice. Something of great importance was being said. At the factories, at 1:30, the guards reappeared and told the POWs to get back to their stations. As Ken Marvin returned to his station, he found his overseers sitting down. One of the Japanese told him that there was no work. Looking around, Marvin spotted Bad Eye, the one-eyed civilian guard he'd been teaching incorrect English, and asked him why there was no work. Bad Eye replied that there was no electricity. Marvin looked up. All of the light bulbs were burning. He turned quizzically to Bad Eye and told him that the lights were on. Bad Eye said something in Japanese, and Marvin wasn't sure he understood. Marvin found a friend fluent in Japanese, pulled him into the room, and asked Bad Eye to repeat what he'd said. "The war is over." Marvin began sobbing. He and his friend stood together, bawling like children. The workers were marched back to camp. Marvin and his friend hurried among the POWs, sharing what Bad Eye had said, but not one of their listeners believed it. Everyone had heard this rumor before, and each time it had turned out to be false. In camp, there was no sign that anything had changed. The camp officials explained that the work had been suspended only because there had been a power outage. A few men celebrated the peace rumor, but Louis and many others were anticipating something very different. Someone had heard that Naoetsu was slated to be bombed that night. The POWs couldn't sleep. Marvin lay on his bunk, telling himself that if they were sent to work in the morning, Bad Eye's story must have been false. If they weren't, maybe the war was over. Louis hunkered down, miserably ill, waiting for the bombers. No B-29s flew over Naoetsu that night. In the morning, the work crews were told that there was no work and were dismissed. Upstairs, Louis began vomiting. As he bobbed in a fog of nausea, someone came to his bunk and handed him 5 letters. They were from Pete, Sylvia, and his parents, all written many months earlier. Louis tore open the envelopes, and out came photographs of his family. It was the first that Louis had seen or heard of them in nearly 2.5 years. He clutched his letters and hung on. The POWs were in a state of confusion. The guards would tell them nothing. A day passed with no news. When night fell, the men looked over the countryside and saw something they'd never seen before. The village was illuminated in the darkness. The blackout shades all over Naoetsu had been taken down. As a test, some of the POWs removed the shades on the barracks windows. The guards ordered them to put the shades back up. If the war had ended, the guards were going to considerable lengths to hide this fact from the POWs. The kill-all date was 5 days away. The next day, Louis was sicker still. He examined his feeble body and scrawled sad words in his diary. "Look like skeleton. Feel weak." The bird reappeared, apparently back from preparing whatever lay in store for the POWs in the mountains. He looked different, a shade of a mustache darkening his lip. Louis saw him step into his office and close the door. On August 17th, at Rokuroshi POW camp on the frigid summit of a Japanese mountain, a telephone rang. Phil, Fred Garrett, and more than 350 other Rokuroshi POWs were shivering through summer inside the barracks, trying to survive on a nearly all-liquid diet. In this extremely remote, deathly quiet camp, the lone telephone hardly ever rang, and the POWs noticed it. A few minutes later, the Japanese commander hurried out of camp and down the mountain. For some time, the Rokuroshi prisoners had been racked with tension. All summer, the sky had been scratched with vapor trails. One night in July, the men had looked from the barracks to see the whole southern horizon lit up in red, generating light so bright that the men could read by it. On August 8th, the guards had begun nailing the barracks doors shut. Then, on August 15th, the guards had suddenly become much more brutal, and the POW's workload, breaking rocks on a hillside, had been intensified. After the commander left, something troubling happened. The guards began bringing the POWs out of the barracks and dividing them into small groups. Once they had the men assembled, they herded them out of camp and deep into the mountain forest, heading nowhere. After pushing the men onward through the trees for some time, the guards led the men back to camp and into the barracks. Later, the walks were repeated. No explanation was given. The guards seemed to be inuring the men to this strange routine in preparation for something terrible. On August 20th, a white sky stretched out over Naoetsu, heavy and threatening. There was a shout in the compound. All POWs were to assemble outside. Some 700 men tramped out of the barracks and formed lines before the building. The little camp commander, gloves on his hands and sword on his hip, stepped atop the air raid spotter's platform, and Kono climbed up beside him. The commander spoke, and Kono translated. "The war has come to a point of cessation." There was no reaction from the POWs. Some believed it, but kept silent for fear of reprisal. Others, suspecting a trick, did not. The commander went on, becoming strangely solicitous. Speaking as if the POWs were old friends, he voiced his hope that the prisoners would help Japan fight the Red Menace, the Soviet Union, which had just seized Japan's Kuril Islands. With the commander's speech finished, and the POWs waiting in suspicious silence, Kono invited the POWs to bathe in the Hokura River. This, too, was odd. The men had only rarely been allowed to go in the river. The POWs broke from their lines and began hiking down to the water, dropping clothes as they walked. Louis dragged along after them, peeled off his clothes, and waded in. All over the river, the men scattered, scrubbing their skin, unsure what was happening. Then they heard it. It was the growl of an aircraft engine, huge, low, and close. The swimmers looked up, and at first saw nothing but the overcast sky. Then, there it was, bursting from the clouds, a torpedo bomber. As the men watched, the bomber dove, leveled off, and skimmed over the water, its engines screaming. The POWs looked up at it. The bomber was headed straight toward them. In the instant before the plane shot overhead, the men in the water could just make out the cockpit and inside the pilot, standing. Then the bomber was right over them. On each side of the fuselage, and on the underside of each wing, there was a broad white star in a blue circle. The plane was not Japanese. It was American. The plane's red code light was blinking rapidly. A radio man in the water near Louis read the signals and suddenly cried out, "Oh, the war is over!" In seconds, masses of naked men were stampeding out of the river and up the hill. As the plane turned loops above, the pilot waving, the POWs swarmed into the compound, out of their minds with relief and rapture. Their fear of the guards, of the massacre they had so long awaited, was gone, dispersed by the roar and muscle of the bomber. The prisoners jumped up and down, shouted and sobbed. Some scrambled onto the camp roofs, waving their arms and singing out their joy to the pilot above. Others piled against the camp fence and sent it crashing over. Someone found matches, and soon the entire length of fence was burning. The Japanese shrank back and withdrew. In the midst of the running, celebrating men, Louis stood on wavering legs, emaciated, sick, and dripping wet. In his tired mind, two words were repeating themselves over and over. "I'm free. I'm free. I'm free." Down on the riverbank, a battered Australian POW named Matt Clift sat at the water's edge. His eyes were on the torpedo bomber, which was swooping overhead, alternately crossing over the river, then the camp. As Clift watched, something flitted out of the cockpit, trailing a long yellow ribbon. It carried through the air westward, directly toward the river. Clift stood up, leaned over the water, and reached out so far that he was on the verge of falling in. The object, a little wooden packet, dropped right into his hands. Regaining his balance with the treasure in his grasp, Clift had a delightful thought. Chocolate! His heart filled with gratitude for the damn good bloke of a pilot above. Clift spent some time trying to twist the packet open, and at some point realized, to his crushing disappointment, that it wasn't chocolate. When he finally got it open, he found a handwritten message inside. "Our torpedo bombers haven't been able to get through this stuff today. We'll lead them back tomorrow with food and stuff. Lieutenant A.R. Hawkins, VF-31, FPO Box 948, Lufkin, Texas." Before he flew off, Hawkins dropped two gifts, a candy bar with a bite taken out of it, and a 20-count packet of cigarettes with one missing. Fitzgerald had the candy bar sliced into 700 slivers, and each man licked a finger, dabbed it on his bit of chocolate, and put it in his mouth. Louis's portion was the size of an ant. Then Fitzgerald had the men form 19 circles, each of which received one cigarette. Each man got one delectable puff. Another American plane thrummed over, and a man fell out of it. Down and down he fell, and his parachute didn't open. Everyone gasped. Then they realized it wasn't a man. It was a pair of pants, stuffed full of something, the waist and leg holes tied shut. The officers retrieved the pants, and Louis stood among them as the waist was opened. Inside, sitting atop a pile of goods, was an American magazine. On the cover was a photograph of an impossibly voluminous bomb cloud. The men fell silent, piecing together the rumors of one giant bomb vaporizing Hiroshima and the abrupt end to the war. Below the magazine were cartons of cigarettes and candy bars, and very soon the compound was littered with wrappers and naked, skinny, smoking men. In a pocket, Fitzgerald found a letter belonging to the pants' owner. The man had been busy. He had a wife in California and a girlfriend in Perth. The rock still sat at the foot of the barracks window, Louis' rope tied around it. But the conspirators were too late. The bird was nowhere to be found. Sometime that day, or perhaps the day before, he had taken off his uniform, picked up a sack of rice, slipped into the Nauetsu countryside, and vanished. Chapter 32. Cascades of Pink Peaches. On August 22nd, Phil and Fred Garrett sat in the Rokuroshi POW camp, wondering what was happening. Isolated on their chilly mountain, the POWs had been told nothing of the momentous events of recent days. All they knew was that the camp commander had been gone for 5 days, and in his absence, the guards had been leading the POWs on ominous walks through the forest. That afternoon, the Japanese commander slogged back up the mountain, looking wilted. He walked into the barracks and approached the ranking American, Lieutenant Colonel Marion Unruh. "The Emperor has brought peace to the world," he said. The commander surrendered his sword to Unruh, who gathered his men and told them that the war was over. The POWs immediately gathered for a Thanksgiving service. They were told that they must not seek revenge. They were officers and gentlemen, and they were to behave that way. The POWs promptly threw a party to end all parties. They demolished the camp fence and built a gigantic pile of wood, described by one POW as 50 feet tall. They asked the Japanese interpreter if he could get them sake, and a barrel full of it soon arrived. The men jacked the lid off the barrel, imbibing began, the pile of wood was set on fire, an Alabaman transformed a huge can into a drum, and inebriated men began dancing. A conga line of crazy drunk POWs wrapped around camp and through the barracks, and one partier did a strip tease, flinging off his clothes to reveal an emphatically unattractive body. The revelry, which went on all night, was so riotous that one man marveled at the fact that all the POWs were still alive when the sun came up. The following day, the hungover POWs walked down the mountain to the nearest villages. They found mostly ghost towns. The civilians had seen the bonfire, abandoned their homes, and fled. The POWs hiked back up and waited for help to come. At Nauetsu, most of the guards stayed in camp, their haughtiness replaced by gushing obsequiousness. There was almost no food and no tobacco. Fitzgerald went to the Japanese commander 3 times a day to demand more food and was rejected each time. POWs left camp in search of something to eat. Someone came back with a cow. Someone else herded in pigs. It wasn't enough. Fitzgerald wrote a dispatch to the Swiss consul in Tokyo, telling of the terrible conditions in camp and asking for immediate help, but the Japanese commander refused to send it. Livid, Fitzgerald threatened to inform the American forces about the commander's behavior, but the commander still refused. At about 10 in the morning on August 26th, 6 days after the war's end was announced in Nauetsu, Fitzgerald was just stepping out of the commander's office when a crowd of American fighter planes, sent from the carrier Lexington, shot overhead and began circling. The POWs charged outside, yelling. They hastily cleared an area, fetched some white lime, and painted 2 giant words on the ground, "Food, Smokes." Messages dropped from the cockpits. The planes had been hauling emergency supplies to POW camps, but had exhausted their loads. The pilots promised that food would soon come. Unable to feed the POWs, the pilots did the next best thing, putting on a 30-minute air show while the prisoners shouted their approval. Fitzgerald stood among his men, moved by their joyful, upturned faces. Wonderful, wrote J.O. Young in his diary. To stand cheering, crying, waving your hat, and acting like a damn fool in general? No one who has not spent all but 16 days of this war as a NIP prisoner can really know what it means to see old